You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
You deserve a moment to yourself every single day. And a delicious bite of a Keebler Sandies can give you that comforting pause. Don't forget to pack the melt-in-your-mouth magic of a Keebler Sandies for a post-errands pick-me-up. This magic is baked into simple shortbread cookies by Ernie and the Keebler Elves. So as life continues to fly by, make the most of your me moment. Take a pause and enjoy a Keebler Sandies.
With AT&T in-car Wi-Fi, stay connected wherever you go and transform your vehicle into a dependable Wi-Fi hotspot. Powering applications like real-time GPS and voice assistant, navigation becomes a breeze. Even on the practice field, AT&T in-car Wi-Fi keeps you connected while in proximity of your vehicle. Work, stream shows, or finish homework without missing a beat. See if you're eligible for a free trial at att.com/in-car Wi-Fi. Don't let connectivity be a roadblock in your journey. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use when vehicle is in operation, compatible device and vehicle required.
Ken Block, and he's a singer for Sister Hazel, and I was fangirling out on you before, Ken, and I hate to be that way because I'm trying to be cool and professional. I was telling you, I've interviewed people like Carrie Underwood, Marie Osmond, some really huge names in music who I love and adore, but you are the music that shaped my life. Like, when I was in high school and college, you were the soundtrack to my existence.
That's really nice to hear.
Yes.
You know, and to be in that company, Marie Osmond, Carrie Underwood, I'm jealous of their hair. But other than that, we're in good company. And hey. I broke my glasses, so I have my wife's glasses on. So don't make fun of me. Don't tease me.
You're styling. You're styling and profiling.
Huh? I'm rocking them.
So how is life for you these days? In the middle of COVID, y'all just started doing drive-in shows. So that's new. I'm in Austin right now, and y'all just played a couple shows in Austin. How's it going?
It's going really well. We did two shows in Austin with Everclear, which was kind of cool. For, you know, we're that band that can play with Everclear, or we play the Grand Ole Opry, or we play with Foo Fighters at a festival, or the Indigo Girls in Atlanta. You know, it's just been a real joy to be in a band that can kind of fall in those different directions. But I thought it went great. Look, for us, I grew up in Gainesville, Florida. University of Florida, Big Southern football school. And it's basically like tailgating with a concert. You know, we ran a full production, light show, the whole deal. That show, we had screens and video. And think about how cool it is. You have your car, you got your space for your cooler and your chairs, your grill if you want it. Then you got another space for social distancing.
Yeah.
That's like grown-up rock and roll show right there.
Yeah.
Right? And so we had a great time. That went well. And then this week coming up, we're going to do Orlando. I'm sorry, Tampa, then Gainesville, Newberry, Florida, which is our hometown. And then Orlando. And then in a couple weeks, Birmingham, Atlanta, and Charleston.
Okay. Awesome. Had y'all just sort of COVID put a damper on your touring? Has it felt good to get back out there?
Oh yeah. We were out, we do a lot of events, and we had this fan centered events, so the Rock Boat and other things that we started, but this started a new one last year where we rented a house out in Tahoe. We had 68 fans, hazelnuts, as they say, come stay in this big mountain chalet thing with us. We were skiing, and that's right when they shut everything down. And so we weren't sure if we were going to be able to get home. The airports were shut down the ski lodge and all that. So by the time we got home on, I think it was March 17th from flying. All our gigs had been canceled through June already then, and then through the summer, and the hits keep coming. So
I know, look,
hey, I'm sure you do. And we can cry about it, but we're like a lot of artists. What can we do about it? So just did a big live stream.
For the first time. I saw that, Celebrating Fortress. Is that the album that just started everything? Champagne High, Offer You, Your Winter, like all of, like, is that what launched it all?
Well, Offer You was the record before it.
Offer You
and Happy and all that. But Fortress had Change Your Mind.
Yes,
Champagne
yes, yes.
High, Your Winner. Beautiful Thing. It's a big fan favorite for sure. Pretty good alliteration.
How did y'all decide to do the live stream for Fortress instead of Offer? Wait, so what was the first one? What was the one that just launched you guys into this stratosphere of Sister Hazel is the greatest band of all times?
It just gets reaffirmed with every record, but some were more familiar. And so we did a little white self-titled record that we made in 3 days, which is basically a demo. And we had sold a bunch of thousands out of the back of our car touring the Southeast. We made Some Are More Familiar. We got it on radio in about 10 cities. We were selling out rooms of about 500 to 1500 seat rooms. We do these little concentric circles away from Gainesville and College Town, Orlando, Tampa, Tallahassee, Jacksonville, Atlanta, Charleston, Auburn, Tuscaloosa, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And just kept hitting them. And these stations took a chance on Offer You, and it started selling. We'd already sold 30,000 out of the back of our van.
No way.
30,000 out of the back of our van. And then the label started calling. And so that's, we signed to Universal, and that's how the rest of America met us.
Dang. What is that like? What is that like to have the dream, to be self-motivated, to be pursuing this dream on your own? You and the guys, y'all, like, obviously you're doing it. You're grassrootsing it. You're selling your CDs by yourself. But then, mm-hmm. like, to realize that it's working, you're getting traction, people are coming, and then to have the record labels come. Like, what does that feel like to have your dream start to work? And was it a long process for you to get there? Or did it kind of, as soon as y'all started making the music and putting it out there, did it sort of start snowballing from the beginning?
Well, I would say that what happened was I had been in bands growing up here in Gainesville. A little bit heavier bands, but I wanted to get out of that because I grew up listening to artists like Simon and Garfunkel, you know, John Denver, Crosby, Stills, Nash, all those harmonies. And then I got into heavier bands, and I always liked all of that, you know, that stuff, the old, you know, sing Hank Williams and then play a Van Halen song. And so I was doing that, but I wanted to go do an acoustic. I was in my band. I want to go start playing acoustic. And then I saw, you know, Jack Sizemore plays guitar Britton Cameron. He's a songwriter up there in Nashville. And Jack Sizemore plays for Jason Aldean.
Oh, yeah.
They were our buddies here in Gainesville. And Britton and Jack were playing, and they were just doing just harmonies and two of them, no band. And I thought, and we were all friends, and it was like, I can't believe they're pulling it off. I mean, we're coming off of the Guns N' Roses
right.
90s. And I go, I want to do more of that. So I started doing that. Got a buddy, ran into Andrew, met up with him. We started playing together. And sometimes we all four get together. And we started getting a little momentum with that. That's when I wanted to start Sister Hazel. I'm like, look, I have all these songs I've written that I want to make. I want to see how good they can be. And I don't want to play, you know, just, you know, 75% covers and 25% originals. I want to play all music that I wrote. And Andrew was at first like, what are you talking about, man? We're making good money. We're drinks are free. And I said, I want to make a whole band. He's like, and split the money by five people? What are you
right?
crazy? But I was like, man, I got to make it happen. And so that's what I tried to piece together was, you know, the lyricism, the harmonies of those singer songwriters, with the energy of sort of the Southern rock bands we grew up with, Tom Petty from Gainesville, Lynyrd Skynyrd. Our first tour ever was with the Allman Brothers.
Wow.
And so that's part of our DNA. And so we just have this ability to kind of take these little pieces and when the five of us get together, it sounds like Sister Hazel. You know what I mean? We make a noise. That yes. noise, for better or worse, is Sister Hazel. So,
did you know when you landed on it? I've been watching a lot of documentaries lately. Like, I just watched the Garth Brooks ones, and I just watched the ZZ Top one. And it's like, to come up with that signature sound, it's like when you, like, get it. Like, because y'all have such a sound. And your voice, you have such a unique voice. I've never heard another voice like yours. When
it's
you have...
It's unique, good.
Unique, amazing. It's incredible. Okay, good. But when you... How did you know when you got it? Like, when it's like, oh, that's it. Like, and what was the song?
Well, All For You was the song for me. But this is a really interesting and funny story. Funny might not be the right word. But I wrote that song in 1991. I was in these heavy bands that I've been playing in. And an environmental trust fund was having like a competition, compilation CD. You know, you got free studio time, had about 100 entries. And the guy called me and was like, hey, man, I know you're turning stuff with the band, but I see you're playing out solo. Do you want to turn something in? And I go, well, I'm working on something right now. And he goes, well, can you come in tomorrow? It's the last day. So I said, yes. I sat in my little apartment, and I had a jam box, right? And it's 1991.
Yeah.
And I had two jam boxes, and I finished All For You, right? I finished in about an hour and a half. And I would sing like, there's been times, kind of play on my roads, you know, all those holes. And then I'd play that cassette and hit record over here. And that would bounce over to that one. And then it would be there. And then I'd add all the third part harmonies and fourth part harmonies. And I thought, okay, there's the map. And I went in there and I made that demo. And I left there and I did. There are a lot of people that just go, you don't know what a hit song is. You know what? No one knows what a hit song is. That's true, that you don't know what a hit song is by how a label's going to push it or timing or whatever. You do know, I feel like I know it's different. It resonates differently.
Yes.
And it doesn't even
feel
mean,
differently. It feels differently in you.
Yeah. And it's just not, it doesn't mean, sometimes it's not even better. It's a better song. It's just, there's that thing. And I drove right to my parents' house and took them out into my 1981 Camaro with the Jensen triaxle speakers in the back. And pulled him out there and said, get my car. I said, if I don't write another song, I think I got one.
Wow.
And that was in 91. And so every time Drew and I would play it out, or there was a couple other songs that got a little buzz too, but every time we play that out, people just lit up. And they'd ask for it. Then we started touring with the band, and that was kind of tape trading time. You're a little younger than me. I used to tape trade. And we'd come into towns and they'd be singing every word to it. And we'd be like, we haven't even been here before. So we knew that we had something that if it got, or I knew, I don't know if everyone in the band believed that. I said, if we can get us in front of people, get it played, we'll do our part by putting on a fun live show that everybody's going to leave there saying that was time and money well spent. And it hit. And, you know, between that record, we had All For You, Happy, and a song called Concede that all charted for us. It was our first platinum record. I mean, we were those kids, those college kids that went from a van and trailer for years. You know, if we sell a couple t-shirts, we get a room that we all sleep in. You know, y'all sleep on the floor for years and years. But we made it real. I mean, we all committed. We got paychecks. They were about $100 a week, $117 a week.
Oh yeah.
After we turn in all our gas receipts and, we split up driving, in our van. It used to be like, okay, how long is this trip? Well, it's 4 hours and 11 minutes. Okay. That's, you get an hour and 6 minutes and you get, and it was like, then we're like, we started going by you a whole tank of gas. We got a little bit smarter by that, but you know, all that stuff. And then all of a sudden, the labels came down and they said, look, they're selling tickets, selling records. Obviously, they work hard. It's resonating, and it's resonating at these radio stations. So they've grabbed us. And we didn't get a chance to remake that first record. We kind of remixed All For You a little bit, which kept our momentum going. But I think we always felt like well, we made that record with our own money in 2 weeks, and we're going up against Matchbox 20 and Third Eye Blind and Tonic and all these bands that have spent, you know, all this time and money on these things. So we went in to do Fortress, you know, we were doggone it. We were going to make sure it was all good. But that ride, once we got on, it was just incredible.
Well, and I kind of like maybe the fact that y'all didn't remake the record and you didn't get just like thrown into the machine and have a producer come in and be like, okay, this sounds great, but let me change it and do this. Like, it sort of kept intact who you guys innately were, it seems. And that just launched and all for you. I mean, that has to be one of your biggest songs you've ever had, right?
Yeah, it was like the most played radio song period in 97 or 98. Yeah.
And that just goes to show to me that when you have something and you feel it and it's magic, and like you said, like the song came to you, I feel that it's bigger than this world. Like, to me, that's when something is bigger at play, like a spiritual element gets involved with it. Do you feel that way?
Absolutely. We all hear it. You hear something, you know, like, I mean, who didn't hear like Adele for the first time and go, that's got something going on. You know what I mean? Like there's things like that, that just certain songs, they have a thing. And I don't think you can name it. I don't think you can, you know, well, it's the way that they blend the voice. It's, those are just kind of, you know, that's a piece of corn in the stew. It's just magic when it all gets together.
Well, and I think you have to have that. Like, when you think of legendary bands, they have, every one of them has those songs that mark time, that are bigger than the song. And like you said, they don't even have to be like necessarily technically like the best song ever written, whatever that even may mean. They just have that otherworldly experience that's involved with that song. And I feel like you have to capture that as an artist in a band to catapult to a level of like fame and like being known, and not that you're doing it for that, but like you have to have that connection with the song that's bigger than just this human experience, I feel like.
And I feel like if you're second guessing a song, you know, from a manifesting point of view, you're shooting yourself in the foot. You really got to be part of it.
Yes.
You know, it's got to be an extension of you.
And you can't have doubt about it.
Right. You've got to be like, I can't wait to play you this song. Not, hey, listen to this song. I know that thing in the second course is a little weird, but check it out. You can't do that.
Yes.
There's no excuses. It's just like, check this out.
This is it. And it's like, if you don't get this, then you don't get me.
That's right. And it's just, let's part friends.
Okay, so you talk about manifesting. I'm not trying to be nosy, but I'm seeing behind you, you have this thing called Your Timeline, and it sounds like looks like you have tons of stuff going on here. Is this a big, are you a big manifester?
Well, my wife is a big manifester for sure. And
I love manifesting.
I tried. So my wife is, I hate being married to someone smarter than me, but she is. So our kids are all in online school right now. And so she does what she calls mom school. Like, so she is, that timeline is, she'll go up there and she'll go, see that? That's about how long you guys are going to live. And you're right here. You're all worried about what's going on here. But what you do between here and here sets up how you're going to be all through here. And she just puts everything in perspective. And like over here, I can't see from here, but it's
that
like,
is such good parenting advice.
Yeah, she's great. You should talk to her one day.
Look, wonderful.
I'm sitting at her desk. Let's see. Safety, ways to exercise, my exercise plan. Can you see?
Uh-huh.
And like, let's see what's something right here. Top test taking skills. And she's working on that with our kids. And so she calls it mom school. And and all my kids are doing great. And so we got like my nieces and nephews, and they'll tune in on like this, like top 10 homework habits.
What are they?
Study at the same time every day, study in the same productive spot, do the hardest thing first.
Yes.
Study a little each day instead of cramming, review your notes, do all your homework, get rid of distractions, use your weekends for review, use your study time to actually study. I'm not good at any of that.
Yeah.
And the most important one to me is ask for help when you need it.
Wow.
You know, and then top 10 study fails, cramming, okay, multitasking, staying up late, skipping breakfast, missing class, unproductive environment, not taking notes, socializing during study group. That's hard, right?
Yeah.
Not using available help and listening. We have an argument in the house about listening to music with lyrics while you're studying.
Okay, what does she say? Like, don't?
She says, no, if you listen to classical or just music without a line that your brain's trying to follow,
okay,
it's fine. But if there are lyrics going on, the science says, that's what she'll say.
So who is your wife? How does she know all this stuff? Because I was terrible at school. I just had a daughter who's 1 year old, and like now that everything's gone virtual, I'm like, all these people are homeschooling. I'm like, I don't know if I could do it. I mean, I was so bad at school. How does she know how to do all this? And that your timeline for your life, to put in perspective, like, don't get so caught up in this tiny section.
That's right.
Because here's your full life. And like what's happening right now is nothing compared to the rest of your life.
That's exactly right. And if it's a huge problem now, it's not going to be then. But you have a chance to set up the whole rest of your life by, you know, look, if you're going to smoke weed, don't do it here. Wait till you're a little, your brain, you know, we're not going to tell you never do that. But get to a place when your brain's finished.
Yes. You know
what I mean?
Yes.
Wait till your brain is done.
Yes.
You know, don't go blackout drink. You know what I mean? Your brain is trying to make a human.
Yes.
So she's real good about all that. And my kids, you know, look, my kids, like everybody's kids, they roll their eyes. But we try to have fun, and she's dedicated her life to helping kids and running little workshops for especially tweens and teens. It's hard to navigate stuff, you know? And so this is a book she's putting together right here.
Well, I'm going to buy it.
Good. You should have her on one day. You'd love her.
I would love to. I would absolutely love to have her on. This would be so fascinating to talk about. And she also has a perspective of being married to a musician. So how do you work marriage and parenting while being on the road? Like, how do you navigate all that? Because that's a lot of factors at play.
Well, out of sight, out of mind. I'm just kidding. Everybody in our band has known from day one that family comes first. So if any of us come in and go, I got to block that off, you know, if we have a little time, if I got to block that off, it used to be a little bit, but now it's like, you block that, go do it. Even if we have to sub someone out sometimes to do something, you know, as long as you've been a band as we have been, you're going to have, you know, somebody get sick, you're going to have big life events, you're going to have all kinds of curveballs that come in. And so family comes first. And so we all step in like that. I think all of us are very invested dads. So for me, when I get home, I mean, I'm taking trash, taking the kids to school, you know, making dinner, going to the grocery store. And I'm in the same town I grew up in. So it's like, hey, you know. But we all of our kids are doing really well. And all of them like each other, which is kind of cool. And all of the wives, it's a little bit easier now because when they were little, that's really tough. I have three kids. And at one point they were all under five, you know, and it's like one's barely moving and one's mobile and mindless, like, you know, licking a light socket or whatever. And the older ones, you know, come back. So I would get home and I would try to do as much as I can. Now, Tracy might tell you, I still didn't do enough, but I know that I tried. I'd straighten my halo and dust off my cape and come charging in. But it was harder, I think, on us than the other guys, because at first, I was the first one to get married. I was the first one to have a kid. And I'd be like, hey, I can't stay out, you know, 31 days in a row without getting, you know what I mean? Like, we got to – and they're like, why? I go, you will understand why. But and so Tracy finally made a couple rules talking to our manager. So we're all family, really. Like, look, let's try to manage 17 or 18 days a month, okay? And then we ended up whittling that back down. I think at some point it got to 14 at some point. But then we started figuring out how to split it out, and we started making more money doing less shows.
Wow.
Which was really weird because we were so used to always saying – you can book Sister Hazel anytime. I mean, they'll play. They'll play.
Yeah.
And when you grow, when you come out of a seam like we did, and you have to take every opportunity, you're programmed that way, right?
Yes.
And so when we all of a sudden said we're not available here or there, all of a sudden our rate went up a little bit. And
interesting.
People went, isn't that interesting?
Yes.
We were all kind of chicken. So we found the sweet spot. We do between, on a big year, 120 dates. Slow year, maybe 90, but we spread them out. And you know, we figured out how to do it.
Man, that is awesome. And that's, I feel like sustainability and balance, and you really can have it all. You have to, I'm sure you, it's a long winding road to figure out that, like as you're calling things like the special sauce or the sweet spot or whatever it is, mm-hmm. like, you know, it probably takes a while to figure it out, but once you do, then it's like, okay, you can truly.
Wait, you say finally I figured out.
You know, I mean, yes. you should write a hit song about that. But truly, once you find it, you can really live a life and kind of do it all and have it all, not have to necessarily sacrifice. I'm sure there was a period where you did feel like you were sacrificing, though.
Yeah, and it's hard. It was really hard on the wives. And you had to learn. We had to learn how to say no.
Yeah, that's tough. That's hard for anybody.
It is really hard. I mean, unless you came off you just win on one of those shows and you win and you have done all kinds of great stuff. But it is different when you've worked for every single show, bar, club, festival, gig you've ever had to say no, or TV. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, if TV wants you, you're like, I can't pass this up.
No.
You know, so it's different. And then, so you have the two worlds though. You've got your family, which all of us are very much on the same page with. Then you have your family, the guys on the bus. You know, you got the band and you got your crew. And we've been touring with a lot of the same guys for 15 years. And as a band, as we're making records and stuff, people are like, how have you not killed each other?
And really? How?
Well, I think at first we almost did.
Yeah.
At first it was like, okay, who's going to stand where in the picture? And
right, you know, right.
Right. And that's recoupable. Don't eat that California roll. Or, you know what I mean? Like, then you get in the studio and it's like, are we going to play the tambourine in the pre-chorus and the chorus or just the chorus? Ah, you get a big fight about something ridiculous like that, or set list. And we just learned one day, it was just like, boom. If it's not gonna matter in 6 months, never mind 6 days or 6 hours, let it go.
How did y'all all get to that point though? Because to get all of you guys to get to that awakening, how did y'all, especially when before you were kind of duking it out, how did y'all get to that point where you're like, we're going to change our mental mentality about this? Like, how did you all agree to do that?
When you said that, what came to mind immediately was when I got sober. Because when I got sober, everybody dialed things back. It wasn't like I was they were a bunch of sober kids sitting around watching dad come on the bus all. But that really gave all of us an opportunity to take a hard look at what we were doing. And if you've ever been around groups of people drinking a lot and playing music, you can have some misunderstandings, and you know, emotions aren't always in check. And at that point, I think we started talking to each other a little differently. We didn't get into some of the arguments that never would have even happened if mm-hmm. people weren't drinking or doing whatever. And then I think the notion that we believed we were all in it for the long haul, that Sister Hazel was the mothership and everything else besides our families, every other project or friend or whatever, jam session or studio, whatever it is, everything feeds back to that. And once we believed that we were all really committed to that, it let everybody kind of be. And the other thing, I know I'm talking a lot, but
I want to hear everything you have to say.
Okay. So I think, and this can't happen right away, I think it's something that happens with time, but like on our first two records, I wrote every song, right? Third record, I wrote almost every song except for one or two. And And, you know, we got in some frustrating conversations about royalties and how we're going to do that. And eventually we just said, we're just going to split all this. Now I wasn't thrilled with that in the moment. You know what I mean? Like I knew, yeah, I had a hit right there. And I kind of expected somebody to maybe go, you know, and I think they've learned since then that, wow, that was a pretty nice thing to have done back then.
That's a big thing to do.
It's a big deal, right?
Yeah, I'd say.
So in that arena, everybody felt ownership. They felt some equality, right? And then when we started to go in and record songs, I started to get more trust in what they were bringing to the table. So instead of me coming in and going, you know, here's Pappy and, you know, we're going to hit it like that. And then you're going to play, I need you to play this groove. And then just kind of going, I didn't get in a band. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We sit around and let everybody do their thing. And then once you let everybody do their thing, they feel such ownership in the song. And everybody's more excited. They're all like,
wow,
that's what I thought of that part. And I, right there where we did that, you know, that the crash grab, or all, little stuff like that. And then there's this real investment, and it helps you to grow. Because for me, if I'm writing everything, you know, forcing the producer to do things a certain way, it's going to be me all the time. But they all became really good writers and really good players.
But you gave them the opportunity to, instead of you holding it so tightly, how did you know that you could trust them with it? Obviously, you're in a band with them, you've committed to them, but what was the moment where you're like, I have to trust them and just let them fly with this too, even though it's, you come in with your vision, your baby, but you're like, I'm going to share this, we're going to do this as a group. Like, how do you get there? Yeah. That's hard to do.
There were a couple of things. Our lead guitar player, Ryan Newell, is a remarkable museum musician. And he was really trying to do this thing that I did not have in my head. It was so different. And finally, I just said, all right, man, just do it like that. Just do it. And I was kind of mad about it that I gave in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then they went to mix record, and the record came back. And I went, oh, my God, he was right. He was right. And then you start going, well, where else might he have been right? And it's better than what I wanted it to be. So then as people start doing that, and they feel confident that they can bring things, they want to bring in the best things, it really started working. And then what we'd start doing is, as more people wrote, is we'd go, look, if you bring in a song, it's our job to serve that song.
Mm.
You tell us what you are hearing, what you want, and we will either serve your vision and try to get you where you want to go, or we will serve what we all collectively hear in this song.
Dang, y'all dropped the egos.
Yeah, check the egos at the door. And
but you did it. But
it's
you
hard,
did
but
it.
You did it. Got to check your egos at the door. And that can't happen in a first year of being a band. Or you got to learn to trust each other. And the other thing is that when you're in a band for this many years, like I said, somebody's going to be on their back, right? Someone's going to have a health issue. Someone's going to have a substance issue. Somebody's going to be going through a relationship issue, you know, on and on, and with the same stuff. We're no different than any other family. But what we've been able to do is every time that's happened to somebody, it's given the rest of us an opportunity to really be there for them and be a brother. So it's leveled the playing field in the sense that we've all needed a little help sometimes from each other, and we've been there for each other.
Dang. Wow. That's pretty powerful.
We'll also rag each other endlessly. You know what I mean? Like, that's what dudes do. Like, it's, we laugh and laugh and laugh a lot in our camp. But we're dudes. We just rag each other hard.
You got to
take it. Yeah. You got to.
This episode is brought to you by Navy Federal Credit Union. At Navy Federal, it's been the mission to help the military community for over 90 years. And not just help them, but do everything to make sure they not only grow, but flourish. That's why Navy Federal Credit Union has all kinds of great savings and investment options, like share certificates with sky-high rates. So don't hesitate. Start growing your finances today with a variety of savings and investment options. Navy Federal Credit Union. Our members are the mission. Savings products insured by NCUA. Investment products are not insured, not obligations of Navy Federal and may lose value.
Now I'd like to introduce you to Meaningful Beauty, the famed skincare brand created by iconic supermodel Cindy Crawford. It's her secret to absolutely gorgeous skin. Meaningful Beauty makes powerful and effective skincare simple, and it's loved by millions of women. It's formulated for all ages and all skin tones and types, and it's designed to work as a complete skincare system, leaving your skin feeling soft, smooth, and nourished. I recommend starting with Cindy's full regimen, which contains all five of her best-selling products, including the amazing youth-activating Melon Serum. This next generation serum has the power of melon leaf stem cell technology. It's melon leaf stem cells encapsulated for freshness and released onto the skin to support a visible reduction in the appearance of wrinkles. With thousands of glowing five-star reviews, why not give it a try? Subscribe today and you can get the amazing Meaningful Beauty System for just $49.95. That includes our introductory five-piece system, free gifts, free shipping, and a 60-day money-back guarantee. All of that available at MeaningfulBeauty.com.
With AT&T in-car Wi-Fi, stay connected wherever you go and transform your vehicle into a dependable Wi-Fi hotspot. Powering applications like real-time GPS and voice assistant, navigation becomes a breeze. Even on the practice field, AT&T in-car Wi-Fi keeps you connected while in proximity of your vehicle. Work, stream shows, or finish homework without missing a beat. See if you're eligible for a free trial at att.com/in-car Wi-Fi. Don't let connectivity be a roadblock in your journey. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use when vehicle is in operation, compatible device and vehicle required.
How did you know it was time to get sober? That's a very humbling realization, and it's a huge life change, especially when you are in you're a musician, you're in a band, there's alcohol everywhere. It's part of the lifestyle. I mean, there's always entertainment going on. It's always a party. Like, how did you know that, like, this is not just a good time anymore? This is, I have a problem and I need to change. And I love that you are vocal about speaking about this. I think it's amazing that you share your story in this way.
Well, I haven't really, thank you. And I haven't really thought about how to share this. So I'm just going to vomit out my story here.
Perfect. I love it.
I think that we all have maybe some traumas in our life and different things. The one in my younger life that was really difficult for me to come to terms with was when I was 16, my younger brother was 14, he was diagnosed with cancer. He and I were, I mean, we were as close as you get. And we fought that together as a family for 4.5 years. And, you know, big ups, serious downs. And when he died, you know, I was 19, just turning 20 or something. I was crushed. I mean, I was devastated and I didn't know what to do with that. That energy, I was still going back and working with some of the kids that I met there. And I just didn't know. It's like when you plan a wedding and then we do all this and do all this, you have a wedding and then the next day I'm done. Right. He passed away. And it's like, what do I do with myself now? I don't even know. And how can this world even be here with him not being here? And, you know, we all look to God perhaps, and, or higher power of your choice, whatever it is that you're praying to and pleading with and bargaining with. And when that doesn't work out, and I'll be honest, I was really mad at God.
How could you even believe in God probably for a while? Like to,
it
for him
took
to,
me, it well, yeah. You know how I knew I believed in him?
How?
I was pissed off at him.
Okay.
It's like, you know what I mean? Like my belief in him was that, yeah, I'm talking to you. You know what I mean?
Yes.
In all honesty, it's like,
how could you do this?
Yes. How could you? And then, you know, trust me, trust you, you know, so I had a lot of baggage with that. Dealing with some of that as the bands were getting bigger and that trauma, you know, keeps coming up.
Originally, you know, did you try to just sort of push it down, the pain of
it? Yeah, I mean, I at first it got really bad, then I tried to push it down and I just knew it was always right here.
Uh-huh,
it was always right in my throat, just right in my throat.
Wow.
And it was, To this day, I mean, it's still a brutal loss for me. Every day at some point I get hit with a wave of it. But there's that. Then there's the stress. And I don't want to be the whiny rock star guy who goes, yeah, my life was so hard. My life was great. I was in a band with guys I liked. We got a big record deal. We hit with that record. We had a great follow-up to that record. We were building a base of people that resonated with what we were doing and were there for the long haul. But with some of that comes pressure. You know, you have money for the first time, pressure within the band for Elba, pressure to follow up a song like All For You.
Oh, man, because it's amazing to have that song, but to have it right out of the gate, then to feel like, how am I ever going to get another All For You? Because here you come it, and now everyone's expecting every song to be like that. But, I mean, luck for you, you were able to follow it up. You had Champagne High, you have your winner, you have so many songs. You did it. You actually did it. But is the stress of that so... unreal.
It was because I'd say a lot of people, and this wasn't really the case for me, but a lot of people, their first record they've been writing their whole life.
Yes. They've been all this time to write it.
All their good songs are right there. And then what? You go to your next record and you're starting from scratch.
Uh-huh.
And so we definitely, you know, we always write it. So every record after Fortress, we had about 60 songs that we'd write that we'd go through and kind of pick. But I want to circle back to the sobriety thing. It just got out of hand, like on the road. I grew up with a bunch of friends that we didn't miss a party. We got involved in other kinds of party favors as well. It was probably a good thing the other guys in my band didn't do that stuff, because that slowed it down for me. Mm-hmm. But in that gap between the end of Somewhere More Familiar and Fortress, things kind of started to come off the rails there. And then at the end of Fortress, it was just I was a hot mess. And
was it a mix of the fame rising as well? Because all of a sudden now you're like at the top of your game and have all this access to stuff.
Well, it's definitely access, but I have access to it now and I don't need it. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's like when you're like that, you walk in a room and you know exactly where to go. Mm-hmm. You look around the room once, like, I'll go over there.
Yep.
Just know how that works. But you know, you do have, you know, you got your vodka bottles, and we drink a lot of Jaeger, which is a whole other thing. But you know, the guys, I started getting the, you need to pull it together, tighten up, that kind of thing. And you know, I miss my wife a lot at that time. And I had a new son at home, and I hated leaving him. So it was just a lot of mixed up emotions, you know. I'm not whining about it. I'm just laying it out there.
Exactly.
But I went to – they took us up to sing. It was a band called well, Tonic was there, and Little Black Backpack. Who sang that song? Anyway, another band, us, and one of the record company guys took us to play for this elementary school. And I had somehow gotten a bottle backstage. I'm like slamming this bottle of Crown and making everybody drink. And I'm like, what? And the last thing I remember was getting shoved in a limousine with a limousine. It's so cliche, right? With a bottle of Crown Royal trying to go find painkillers. It's like, well, you know.
It's straight out of a Hollywood rock and roll movie.
Right. I got out. And apparently that weekend, as I was still off and running, my manager, my wife, the band guys all said, we got to do something. So by the time I got home, I heard my wife on the phone, something like something by the sea. And I was like, that sounds weird. That sounds like a place. Maybe. What are you doing? And she goes, hey, let's go over to Lynn's house. And I got intervened by him. Went. I had my, you know, longtime high school friends. I had my wife. I had my whole band, crew, management, and they just said, hey man, we don't want you to die, and we don't, you're not the best guy you can be. And I knew they were right. Mm. Which really is hard. It's hard to know they're right. There was a show called Happy Days. I don't know if you ever know that.
Yeah.
And the Fonz, he he couldn't say he was wrong. He'd always be like, I was, he couldn't do it. That's kind of how, you know, I was wrong. But I went away and I went down to South Florida for a little over a month. Hated it. Bombs kept going off while I was, this is the worst part. This is where everyone watching this is going to hate me. But please know that we made it through this and we're married 24 years now. My wife was pregnant with our daughter. And she drove me down to West Palm Beach for this rehab center. And she was driving home and the car broke down on the middle of the interstate. She can't reach me there. She's pregnant.
Oh, man.
And I can't reach her. It was like nothing was going well. You know what I mean? So I knew I couldn't run, which some people had done. And I would do that because the only place I want to go was home. She goes, look, you're not coming home until you do the hard work.
Wow.
Do the hard work. And so I did that. Looking back, it was incredibly important that I did that and went through that. And I managed to stay sober for almost 17 years, almost. And then I did have a relapse in the last, it was a little over a year now, which we'll talk about again. I'll circle back around to that. But I'm back in the game, and we nipped it in the bud pretty quick. But, you know, it allowed me to create, I wasn't creating any new problems when I got in sobriety. I had to kind of learn about myself. I had to take care of the issues that I had created between me and other people. I had to, you know.
Did you have to dive into your pain?
Oh man, there's no way around it. You got to go through it.
So you finally, like, you had to like dive headfirst into your trauma too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, that was not fun, but neither is chronic pain. Like, it's like,
were you having, because you said it was in your throat and you keep grabbing your throat when you're talking about this.
Yeah,
was it affecting your voice, your singing voice? Was it affecting you?
It's funny you say that because a little bit I would get sort of tension stuff in there. But what happened a few years ago, we went down to Honduras and we adopted this village and we got all these kids sponsored. They lived on the bottom of a garbage dump. I mean, it was incredible. And we built a feeding center for them and we built the water treatment thing for them. And on the way home, I got really sick, like really, really ill. Chest, respiratory stuff. They couldn't figure out what it was. Turned out, it took me to Mayo Clinic. I had three super bugs, MRSA, Klebsiella pseudomonas, all in my lungs. And from coughing, I hemorrhaged my larynx. Now for me, that's like, you know, that's my hammer. That's my saw. And so I tried to push through, and in pushing through, I developed some neurological stuff. You can hear it a little bit. And I'm just getting through it now. It's taken years to kind of work back through that. Where, it, you know, it's been hard. That's been hard. It's like taking away someone's superpower and your confidence and your, I even told my wife earlier, I go, man, I can't wait to talk to her, but I hope my voice works because sometimes it just doesn't want to work.
So that's how.
That's been traumatic.
I feel that is traumatic. And I feel though, like what you've definitely, like going into sobriety, dealing with your pain, having this happen to your voice, like you've had some major, like you said, you don't want to be a whiny musician complaining because obviously we're all super fans of you and you have a great career and a great life. But you have some real stuff that you've had to deal with. How do you deal with having your instrument, your moneymaker, your identity, your livelihood now being threatened and all that? Like, what does that do to you on top of, like, you know, dealing with the sobriety and all that? Like, how do you manage that? That's really hard and scary.
You nailed it. I mean, I tried to manage it for the first couple of years. And then I got to a point where I knew if I could just get out of the way, like if I could get my tension and my whatever the glitch is that's going on out of the way. And that's when I thought, well, my drink will help that.
Uh-huh. So that's kind of what led back to, if you could just relax a little bit.
Yeah,
have
if I could
drink.
Get out of the way and not overthink it. And so, yeah, and it would help. So it was telling me it was fixed, but it was also, it also told me that it's not as bad as I think it is. If I can do it when I'm out of the way better, I should be able to do it without, you know what I mean?
Mm.
So it did kind of take me down a little bit because once you don't want to wake that beast up again.
Right.
He does not forget. You know, he's over there, as they say, he's over there in the corner doing push-ups, waiting for you to call him into the game.
How did you know you couldn't even like just lightly play around with it? Like, how did you know? Because you said you nipped it in the bud.
Well, I'd be lying if I said I nipped it in the bud. I was drinking. We did the rock boat. You know, mm-hmm. We started this thing called the rock boat, which let's talk about that later.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was doing a thing with Andrew, and he said, "Man, were you drinking last night?" I was like, "No." He's like, "Are you sure?" I'm like, "No, man, I wasn't drinking." And I typically just drink Red Bull or whatever. It's not healthy for you, but I'm not drinking booze. Anyway, I got done with that night, this next night, and he was mad. I go, "Why are you mad, man? We had a great show." He goes, "Because you're drinking, man." I go, "What are you talking about?" He goes, "I grabbed your Red Bull can, and it's full of straight Jack Daniels." And I'm like, "Because there's no hiding it anymore. You know what I mean?" And Andrew will go right. Andrew has known my wife longer than I've known my wife. So they're tight, and he's not going to let me try to dupe anybody. It's like, "Look, you got to talk to her, and you got to talk to Tim, our manager, and I'm just not letting you out of it, so we got to make a plan." So I did that. I did it one other time or a couple other times, weekend, three weekends. No, I'm just kidding.
Was it probably did it feel like
quick.
That?
So here's where it wound up the last time. So we're in so it went from that to me hiding drinks in my backpack.
Yeah.
Getting some pills, anti-anxiety pills or painkillers, and you know, being a sober guy on the bus for a lot of years, they know what you're like. Well, we had played a show in Seattle, I guess last summer, not just last summer, one before, and there was a hot dog guy out front after the show, and I had ordered two hot dogs, and I never do that. I open the door and I walk in, and they're all looking at me, and I'm like, "What's up?" I go sit down, I'm holding two hot dogs, and I think I ate them both, and the TV was on up in the front lounge, and I hear Andrew go, "Hey man, wake up." I go, "I'm not sleeping." He goes, "You're not sleeping. I'm watching TV." He goes, "Man, you're not watching TV. You're sleeping. Go to your bunk." So I went to my bunk, and the next morning about 8 o'clock, we were in Portland, and he opened the blind and said, "Get your ass to a meeting." And I did, got my ass to a meeting, and
Wow. Got
back to Gainesville, got back with my sponsor. Jamie had got hooked me up with a new sponsor. And but look, to all the folks out there that are want to go out on a couple of missions, it's not worth it. It's just not worth it. It's really hard to come back. For me, it was hard, first of all, because it just woke that beast up a little bit. I'm talking after 17 years.
Truly.
It's not like you go back and you can work your way back up. You're a pro, man.
Yeah.
You're a pro. But I felt really embarrassed that I had been looked up to by a lot of people, that I had put my sobriety out there, and I was going to have to come back in. And, you know, the 19-year-old college cheerleader that came into the meeting is 3 days sober, and she's got more sobriety than I do. That was humbling. You know what I mean? So I got right back in it, and with, you know, nobody judged me. All that judgment was me. Everybody was just glad you make it back, because a lot of people don't make it back. And I've been able to make progress with my voice now that that's not an option.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, and that makes sense, because finally your sobriety was so important to you that you were going to stick with it no matter what, until now all of a sudden what's even maybe feels more important, your voice is now feeling threatened. And so it's like what you got to do in your mind. It's like, you've got to do whatever you can to get your voice back. I can see why your brain works this way and how it can happen, you know?
Absolutely.
But now that you know, like it, like you said, the beast is waiting. It's not, it's not a gradual thing, but you know what, Ken, here's what I think. I think for you to relapse and then to come back and say, here I am, I'm back at the starting point, I'm putting this out there. Yes, it is humbling. Yes, I am a little embarrassed about it. But you know what? Who hasn't had moments in their life where they're like, oh, I hate that I'm right here. I hate that this is happening. I wish this wasn't this way. But to be able to say it and man up and own it, that to me is the most impressive trait a human can have, because so many people do not want to own stuff. They want to like avoid it. Yeah. They want to sweep it under the rug. They want to act like nothing's wrong, but we all have moments like that. And I think that that is the most beautiful thing about human beings, when they can actually be like you and be like, okay, it happened. Here I am. I'm still an awesome person, and I'm getting back on track the way I want to. And that's, I think that that is more inspiring to people than anything, because we're all needing people like that.
Or even if you're coming and you're saying, I'm a broken person right now, you're going, that's where the people can connect to you.
Yes.
Because they can feel it. So, you know, I tell some people who are very close to me, I'm like, when you're being vulnerable, we can access you.
Yes.
But when you have your walls up.
Yes.
You're not only inaccessible, you're making us mad.
Yes.
You know, you're pushing us away, and that's not what you want. So, I'm not afraid to get in there and roll up my sleeves and talk about the stuff, but.
But, I mean, that's a big deal, and that is so impactful to so many people, because this is a life-threatening thing. I mean, a lot of people, like you said, don't get on the other side of it and don't get to the place where they have people looking out for them who can help them like you did, or know in themselves and like have a moment where they're like, I got to get help. I think that you speaking up and being someone who is such an influential person and saying like, listen, it can happen to anybody, happen to me, but like get help, help yourself, and don't be ashamed of it and be vulnerable, because being vulnerable, that's the key to life, or else you slowly die.
Because
you're just
really
trying to be
hard.
So strong.
It really is hard, especially for guys, I think, in a lot of ways. But to ask for help.
Yes.
I need help. But, I mean, I have a daughter, not for drinking, but she doesn't like to ask for help for one of them. She doesn't like to ask for help for anything. She thinks it said something about her. You're not better than me. You know, she's got the thing. But I'm like, look, what is it? The guy that wrote Hallelujah, and he has that thing he says.
Is it Jeff Buckley?
Not Buckley. It's the guy that actually wrote it. Leonard Cohen.
Oh, yeah.
And he wrote, and it says, you know, something about the crack. Well, that's the way the light gets in, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, and there's this Japanese art where they take these ceramic bowls and they break them and they fix them with glass, and the broken parts are what makes it so beautiful. It's awesome. I feel that.
Yes.
You know, I feel that.
And so, I think that just being that way that you are, and letting yourself be vulnerable and allowing other people to connect to you on that very deep personal level, that's what life's about. I mean, that's the connection.
I agree. That is where life is. That's where the energy is. That's where the good stuff happens. And the braver people are to allow themselves to get to that point, either in vulnerability or in being there for somebody. That's the magic.
That's the magic.
That's the magic.
That's the magic. And I just keep thinking, like, 2020 has been just a freaking what a year for everyone, you know. And if anything it's taught me, it's like, what are we all trying to be so put together for? Like, what are we all trying to hold it all together and act like everything is flawless? It's flawed. everything's flawed. We're humans. Oh, this world is broken. It's a fallen world. Like, there's all sorts of stuff that's just never going to be perfect. So why would we even try? Why are we even trying? Let's just put it out there how it is. Let's be real. Let's connect. Yeah. Let's let everyone feel like we're in this together and we're helping each other out. Like, you're down. Let me help you up. I'm down. You help me up. Like, why are we trying to act like somebody we have it together? I can't anymore. I can't do that. Exactly. Like,
well, if it makes you feel better, I'm just wearing shorts. You know what I mean?
Like, I'm in a sweatshirt.
Right? I don't really have it all together. I didn't want to put that vibe out there. But yeah, I think, you know, I will say for me, and I don't know about your boy or couples that have musicians in their family. My entire adult life has been traveling and touring, and most people in their lives really crave adventure. And I think some of us who've been doing it as long as we have, you crave for a little bit of structure, a little consistency, a little consistency. Like, I can plan what I'm going to eat this week, or I know when I'm going to bed, or I can actually work out like this. Now, I'm not saying I do all those things because I'm still a procrastinator stuck in the body of a perfectionist, but I have never had this ever where I'm home. I can write a little bit. You don't have any excuses. You know, it's like, I can do all those things I kept fussing about. I can write today, or I can go out to that state park over there today, or I can take the kids out and, you know, beam them in the head with a football or whatever. But, you know, like, but it's, I've never had time like this. So I'm trying to appreciate that part of it. But it's some weird stuff, man. It's some weird stuff.
It is. Man, Ken, I would talk to you forever, but I'm not going to steal all your time because you have so many other things to do with your day besides talk to me. But I do have just like a couple more questions, and one of them being your winter. That is like truly one of my favorite songs in the entire world. What inspired that song? And how do you get that emotion in your voice when you sing it? Because like, it's going to weird you out how many times I've listened to that song. I just love that song so much.
Well, I'll make it funny for you then, if that's the way you listen to that track. First, I'll talk about writing it. I did not write it about me. I wrote it about, I won't throw them under the bus, but they're both people that are known by a lot of people now. They weren't at that time. We were just close. But they were in a relationship and they really love each other. But man, for some reason, they just couldn't get it together. They were misreading each other. It just wasn't as it should be. And so anyway, I sat in next to a pool in a Days Inn in Tuscaloosa, Alabama. We were still in a van and trailer, and I started writing that song. And by the time it got done, I thought, man, I got one. I like this. I kind of felt like what's that, Matchbox 20 Push, kind of had a little bit of that feel, you know. So we had made this little tape, I mean a cassette tape, at Andrew's house, and somehow, I have no idea how this happened, it got in the hands of the music director for that movie 10 Things I Hate About You.
Yes.
Right? So they flew us out to LA, and we were at Ocean Way out there, and had a producer. We had Beck's dad came in with string section, and I loved the way it came out. Anyway, I might have a little bit of a lisp, right? And sometimes it'll come out. First time it came out, was on a song called Concede, and the bridge is, "I'll be your jester, be your fool." I'm like, "I'll be your jester, be your fool." So they made fun of me forever that. Well, the first line of your winner is, "The gray ceiling on the earth, well, it's lasted for a while." And I sat in there for 3 hours. I'm not kidding, in that booth. "Gray ceiling on the earth, well, it's lasted for a while." I couldn't get it. He goes, "You're doing it again." I'm like, "No, I'm not." And I'd be so mad. I'd be like, "Run it again, run it again." "Gray ceiling on the earth." terrible, man. It was so frustrating, but I love the way that that song came out.
Oh, it's perfect. It's a perfect song.
Oh, thank you very much. And one of the first people I played it for was Lynn Oliver. Do you know Lynn? Lynn and Chris Cappy, they manage Luke Combs now.
Yeah. Cappy,
I've known since he was in college. We've been really good friends ever since Hazel got started. He booked us to play at, I want to say it was Emory or somewhere in Atlanta. We became fast friends, and he worked for the band. He worked for the Rock Boat, Six Man. And anyway, Lynn, who works there with him, we had sent our first record up there to try to get on the first, on a little run with Hootie. And they were just kind of taking off. And we didn't hear back. And Lynn called down and she said, "Hey, I just wanted to tell you, we can't give you those dates, but I love your CD and everyone in the office, we can't take it out. We're listening to it. This is our first little white record." And she goes, "So I want to help you. Have you been able to get to Carolinas yet?" And I was like, "No." And she goes, "I'm going to book you shows up here." So she booked us at Rockefeller's, the Elbow Room, and then got us over to Bobby Ross at a Windjammer and Pile of Palms.
Yeah.
And we would go up and spend the night at her house. And for years, we'd just go up, spend the night at her house. And man, all those connections. I'd see these people I've known all that long, and they're still impacting the music world. It's a lot of fun to see.
Well, I think that it's an energy. Like even everyone, and Marie Osmond actually told me this, and I've never forgotten it. She's like, everyone's on a different ride on the elevator or the escalator. And like, some are going up, some are going down, and it shifts, but you always kind of meet in the middle. So it's just like that energy that draws people together in the music industry. Like everyone's kind of moving at different paces, but you're all drawn to this force field, and it's all meant to be, you know? It's really cool. It's a really magical thing.
It is. There is some kind of consciousness, some kind of thing we're all a part of, whether we know it or not.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're, as they say in your world, in the manifesting world, if you're vibrating at the right speed, you're going to find other stuff like that. And I mean, who hadn't had that happen?
Totally.
Whether they're calling it manifesting or manifestation, it doesn't matter. That's what it is.
Yes, exactly. So, whether you know it or not,
and those coincidences and mm-hmm. those, yeah, it's kind of cool. I'm not that fruity, you guys, but I get it.
I know. I love it. Okay. So two more questions. I'm going to wrap up and I'll let you go. Yes. This has been such an amazing interview for me, like truly a bucket list moment. I'm so thankful we got to talk. I love getting to hear your heart and story.
Cool.
What has being a husband and parent changed about you and taught you?
Well, I had a lot of time to think about that recently.
Mm-hmm.
I will say that always they have been more important to me than anything else. And I think because I lost a brother as a teenager, I really feel that things can be finite.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just the fact that mine are now 15, 17, 20, and they're all healthy. That was right the time period where our house got turned upside down.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all healthy, they're happy, they're athletic, they're funny. I got to spend this time at home with my wife, and people keep talking about the big fights they're having. We haven't really had that, so I feel really lucky about that. It's that big thing that I need isn't out there. It's already here. So I know that, and I feel that, and there's, today, if you told me we were going to go play on, Jimmy Kimmel next week, I'd be like, cool. And they go, but would you rather hang out with your family at the beach that weekend? I'd be like, I might rather do that. And that would sound crazy, right? But
no, it doesn't. It doesn't. It doesn't at all. And that's a beautiful place to be. What a great place to be.
It is a beautiful place to be. So, I really do feel lucky. I'll feel luckier when I get all this back. Which I'm going to do. It's just taking time all that voice stuff. But, my kids and my wife have always been, I made the right choices and I got lucky in the right ways.
So. That's awesome. And we didn't talk about Rock the Boat, 'cause you're one of the first ones to
start
the Rock
Cruises. Yeah. We started it. We carved out that niche. So
And those are awesome.
Aren't they cool?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So, all right. So here's the cliff notes.
Okay.
We got our big platinum record for Somewhere More Familiar, and our fans were, we had one of the first message boards that you could kind of get on, and that was really a big deal. And they wanted to do something with the band. And so we all were trying to figure out what to do. And if you ask different members of the band, everyone takes credit for different pieces of it. I'll take credit for saying we got to do something.
Yeah.
Mark, our drummer, had worked on cruise ships and had brought it up. And Andy Levine, who ran Six Man, he was our manager. Sorry, I'm talking too fast. He was our manager, and he was his company's called Six Man because he was the sixth man of the band.
Oh, right? So, okay.
Right. So Andy happened to be on an airplane next to a travel agent and said, "Hey, we're thinking about doing something. What do you think?" And she said, "Well, why don't you take a half a ship and sell the cabins?" So we said, "Let's do it." So we did it. We took half a boat. We took one other band, Dexter Freebish, and it was awesome. Played like two shows. People loved it.
Yeah.
I got off the boat and I looked at Andy and I went, "We're on to something."
Yes.
And the second year, chartered a whole boat, had like 28 bands, and turned it into a festival. We have not sailed. It's sold out every year. This is the 21st year. I don't know of any festival or even event that has gone on outside of award shows that have gone on that long.
So y'all started the cruise ship Rock the Boats.
We started it. We own half of us and half Six Man.
So every band that does a cruise ship experience tour?
Everyone that does. So we only own the Rock Boat, which is the first one. And then Andy expanded Six Man and does the other ones. So wow. He owns those, but that was all.
But y'all started
all
it.
We started it, yeah.
That is epic. Yeah. I mean, because every band does those now. I mean, that's so cool. How cool to be like the legends that started it. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's one of those legacy things that
you
know, we'll be able to look back on and go, that's a niche that we started. And we didn't call it the Sister Hazel Boat, which we could have done. We wanted it to be about the sum of the parts. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yep.
We wanted it. So every year people came on and you bring on a few headlines. We want you to come on because you know a headliner, but we want you to leave because you found your next favorite band.
Oh, I love
that.
So
we have this mix of younger bands and female artists and genre all over the map, because that's kind of how I like to listen to music.
That's so cool.
So you got to come. It's amazing.
Oh, yeah. I love it. That's so awesome.
We had to move it this year because of all the COVID. It was supposed to go in January. It's set for next November, but we'll see how it goes.
Oh, yeah.
We'll get there eventually.
Heck yeah. Oh, that's awesome. I freaking love that. That's so cool. Okay. I wrap every interview with Leave Your Light. What do you want people to know?
I want people to know, with regards to our band, that that we take very seriously the role we play in people's lives, and that we want to use our platform for good. And it has been an honor to be plugged into all these different causes that are worthy, or to show up at places and just lighten people up. But the one that has meant the most to all of us is Lyrics for Life, which I started for my brother. We've all lost people to cancer. We've raised over $3 million for children's cancer research and programs that help those families. And we opened a kids camp called Camp Hazelnut, where we scholarship in about 120 of these kids and families to go out for a 3-day weekend in the cabins, just like summer camp. They do archery, canoeing, rope climbing. We have parties and luaus, and they write songs with us. And, you know, if you're in a band and you have opportunities to take your platform and make it about more than you, that's where the rubber meets the road. And, we've been really lucky to be able to impact people in a lot of different ways.
Wow. Ken, thank you so much for sharing your heart
Thanks
with me.
Thanks for having me.
Sharing your journey, your story. You are truly, you know, like they always tell you, don't meet people that you really like, love, yeah, and look up to, because it could be like a massive letdown.
Yes,
you exceeded all expectations. Now, like, now, my love for you and Sister Hazel has just amplified. This is such a treasure and treat to me.
I had a great time talking to you as well. It was a great interview and we had fun. Right?
Heck yeah. Oh yeah. It was the best. It was so great.
Then you and I'll catch up soon, all right?
Okay. I appreciate it. Thank you so much, Ken.
Bye.
Right here, right now. Find your beautiful new floor at Right Rug Flooring. Choose from thousands of in-stock styles ready for next day installation and all backed by the right price guarantee. Visit rightrug.com, that's RITERUG.com today to schedule a free in-home estimate or to find a location near you. 24-month financing is available with approved credit. For 90 years, we've been right here, right now. Right Rug Flooring.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.